friends, and we just want you to know that we're not dead, and we're alive, and you're alive, and that's good.
Yeah, so appreciate very good. You, yeah. Well, yeah. Let's make some noise. You know, we're alive. Thank you so much for listening. I've been Althea Billings.
And I have been and always will be Tammy of Tass. Thank you all so much.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:58 a.m.
This is Mark Torres, senior producer at the Pacifica Radio Archives, and this is From the Vault, our original weekly program that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. On this edition of From the Vault, we celebrate the life of Muhammad Ali through our Pacifica Radio Archives recordings.
Martin Luther King, a big black man, bumped him off in your face unjustly. Muhammad Ali, the biggest black man in all history of boxing, bumped me off unjustly in your face. So excuse expression, money ain't worth a damn thing when it comes to wanting to be a man. And I'm proud to say that I'm the first black man in the history of all America, athlete and entertainer wise, who gave up all the white man's money.
Maya Angelou wrote, "While many encounter many defeats, one must not be defeated." It didn't seem that Muhammad Ali would have to learn that lesson as his life unfolded like a dream come true. Let's hear from former Pacifica producer Roy Hurst, who narrates this 1997 tribute to Muhammad Ali.
With the appearance of Muhammad Ali lighting the torch at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, and more recently the release of the Leon Gass film When We Were Kings, Muhammad Ali has reemerged as one of the world's most recognizable public figures. That wasn't always a good thing for him. Born Cassius Marcellus Clay, he became internationally known by winning the gold medal in the 1960 Olympics in Rome. He turned professional and quickly rose through the ranks, becoming the heavyweight champion of the world on February 25, 1964, by defeating the heavily favored Sonny Liston. The day after winning the title, he shocked the public by announcing that he had converted to the very unpopular religious group, the Nation of Islam. He added that he would forever be known as Muhammad Ali, which translates in English, "worthy of praise." Meanwhile, America's involvement in Vietnam was escalating. Muhammad Ali was drafted and ordered to report for induction on April 28, 1967. Ali appeared at the Armed Forces Examining and Entrance Station and formally refused induction. Moments later, the New York State Athletic Commission stripped him of his heavyweight boxing title and suspended his boxing license. The remaining 49 states followed suit, and 10 days later, Ali was indicted by the federal grand jury in Houston. Ironically, the man who ultimately approved Ali's prosecution was probably the most liberal attorney general, Ramsey Clark. That same day, he was released on $5,000 bail on the condition that he not leave the continental United States. These two rulings by the Athletic Commission and the United States Grand Jury in effect took away Ali's livelihood, but he eventually discovered that he could make money on the college lecture tour. Pacifica producer Julius Lester recorded an interview with Ali during this period of exile. Ali was first asked about the possibility of fighting on Indian reservations.
Yes, we're working on a few Indian reservations. Now we are just about to wind up a deal, if everything goes like we expect it to, on a reservation not far from Seattle, Washington, and then there's one not too far from Phoenix. And the one in Seattle seems like the most likely, but we're now negotiating. My manager, Herbert Mohammed, and business manager, C.B. Atkins, they've been working and working, and I think they have now gotten it. And the major problem is finding a suitable opponent. I don't think we can get Ellis and Frazier. They're ducking me. Joe Frazier and James Ellis, those the two so-called homemade champs they got. I think they're ducking me. And now we're trying to negotiate in England, Germany, Canada, and possibly maybe some top contenders in the States. So that's where we stand right now. We're sure the fight and everything and the site is ready, but the real true Americans are going to let me fight on their land, what little land that the white man left them.
Next, Muhammad Ali talks about his experiences on the college lecture circuit.
I've been mainly invited. I have 68 college invitations, and they all want me to speak on racial problems. What do I see as the solution? They want me to clarify the works and the missions of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. They want me to speak on the draft, why I denounced it. What do I think about the title? Why did they take it? How did I start boxing? And we just go on and go on. The presidential election, who am I for? And all these type questions. And there are many we answer and some we have to sort out that we don't answer. But usually I have all of my lectures designed from the book that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has out, A Message to the Black Man, speaking on titles such as We Must Respect and Protect Our Women, What the Muslims Want, What the Muslims Believe, Do We Must Do for Ourselves, We Must Help Self Before Helping Others, We Must Respect Our Own Selves and Unite and Separate from Our Slave Masters, and all type lectures. Well, it's just beautiful.
Muhammad Ali comments on the acceptance of the teachings of Elijah Muhammad on the black college campuses.
Yes, sir. All the black students, they have their own Muslim meetings. They don't call them Muslim meetings, but they are. They don't allow no whites in the meetings now. And all of this is from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And they read the Muhammad Speaks newspapers. They call each other black now. They call each other brother. They call each other sister. He's been preaching this for the past now 38 years, but they don't follow him all the way. They don't want to follow him spiritually and divinely. So our people are not criticizing them. We cannot criticize a baby. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us who starts trying to talk. At least he's trying. And our people are starting to think in the way of black, but they're not yet all the way with the right man. But gradually they're coming more to the Muslim program daily. Everything that's designed, we must build, get our own businesses. They're arguing about they want their own businesses. That's the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. At the latest Black Power rally, they said we want separate states, want our own states. That's the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. All of them know the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Every black man today, you find him and say, As-salamu alaykum. He'll say, wa alaykum salam. For the first time, he's speaking his own language. You hear names like Hassan and Omar and Akbar and Ahad and Ishmael and all kind of names today. All this comes to Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
Muhammad Ali was given many opportunities to join the armed services in a non-combat role. This way he would avoid criminal charges, and he would continue fighting exhibition matches to entertain the troops. But Ali stood by his principles as a Muslim and refused these compromise offers.
Man, Negroes have been made like white people. And many of them say, "Champ, you know something? You got a right to believe what you want and all this and all that, but what about the money? This is our trouble today. All Negro, so-called Negroes worry about is money. He's like the white man now. He'll blow up his mama for some money and sell out his people for some money. That's why we're nowhere today, because all the big Negroes with some money is up on the hill with the white folks, riding with the white folks, going to church with the white folks, marrying the white folks, shuffling and tomming and loving white folks, and they forget all about the brother down there in Harlem, his rent's due, living in a bad home, standing on the corner, nobody know him, nobody want him, and he rides by in his limousine. Well, let them niggas make it like me. I can't take no chance on losing my money. Once we become followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the flesh and the blood of our people is more important than the white man's money."
Muhammad Ali was banned from boxing for a total of 3.5 years. While his case was inching through the appeal process, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund won a suit against the New York State Athletic Commission in federal court, arguing that they discriminated against Ali when they revoked his boxing license. The State Athletic Commission denied Ali's boxing license because he was a convicted felon, when in fact they had licensed many boxers who were convicted criminals. The court ruled that this was a violation of Ali's rights under the 14th Amendment. The State Athletic Commission complied with this ruling and immediately reinstated Ali's boxing license. After a few preliminary fights, Muhammad Ali had his sights once again on the heavyweight championship. On March 8, 1971, he would have his chance. Ali faced off against fellow Olympic gold medalist and current champion Joe Frazier, but he would have to fight public opinion as well. The fight became the Patriot versus the Draft Dodger, the Bible-reading Baptist versus the Muslim, the soft-spoken Joe against the loud-mouthed Ali. Ironically, Joe Frazier, an African-American, was the great white hope. The following is an excerpt from the Ali Frazier pre-fight press conference.
"Mohammed, there's rumors around that you slow down in the latter part of the ring. Is this true or is it just a rumor?"
"Yeah, I don't dance and move like I used to as much, because mostly I was so far advanced for my age. I was fast and skillful, and I didn't hit as hard. My bones were, I'm 29 now, I'm just right. I either bruise or cut or knock out. When I hit now, after 2 or 3 rounds, something happens. I can wait around a while. I don't have to move as much as I used to."
"Now, Brother Ali, some people have been saying that Frazier's being built up like the great white hope against you. Do you see any racial implications to the fight?"
"Well, I don't think he's been built as a great white hope in as far as, I imagine he's got a lot of rooters. It's supposed to be. I mean, everybody can't be rooting for me. I want them all to be mad. I wish they all boo when I go in. I fight better. When I'm the favorite, then I'm in trouble. Like Bonavina, this all 6-1 favorite, no contest. And I didn't even train. I didn't run. I stayed up all night, a couple nights for the fight, debating with friends. Didn't eat like I should. And I wasn't off. See, I'm ready when I'm the underdog and all the people are coming and half of them are voting for him and half of me. Man, I'm just, you know, I got more people to whoop than just Frazier. See? But when, you know, I like to be the underdog. I like this kind of talk. This is beautiful, picking Joe Frazier to whip me. Oh, it's so beautiful, because after the fight, I have roll call. Fred? Heck no. Me or Fred? Man, I've been to the boxing school. This looks rough to you all. I was on a plane coming here, and he hit some rough turbulence, and I was frightened, a jumbo jet. I was upstairs, and I ran down. I went to the pilot, and I said, I says, "All right, can you go over it?" He said, "Oh, we go through this all the time. This is light. These wings are made to span 17 feet. They're only going about 4 feet." So he wasn't worried. The unknown, it looks frightful to you fellas. You sitting at the typewriter and you drinking every night and you laying with your girlfriends. And boxing looks rough to you, but this is easy when you're in shape and young and good like I am. It ain't hard. Easy. Boxing is easy. I look at me, I don't get hit, cut, and bruised. I don't worry about nothing like that. This is just another night for me. The way you all build it up, Life magazine cover, Time magazine, everybody gives their opinion. Dempsey says I'll lose. Joe Louis, and when Joe Louis said I'm going to lose, I said I knew I done won this one. But Joe Louis always picks the wrong man. Always pick the wrong. Where Joe Louis at? Joe Louis is here tonight. Where's
yeah,
Joe
he's
at?
Around.
Joe Louis! Joe Smart.
Muhammad Ali lost this fight, but would avenge this loss by defeating Frazier their remaining two fights. Ali regained the heavyweight title in 1974 by defeating the most dangerous fighter of the time, George Foreman. Muhammad Ali is much larger than his Olympic gold medal, his heavyweight championships, and his Supreme Court victory. He sacrificed his world title, his career, and his fame to stand up for what he believed was right.
That was Roy Hurst narrating our 1997 tribute to Muhammad Ali. Now that we have the big picture, let's go back to September 1968, when the audio from this tribute was recorded by Pacifica producer Julius Lester. From his home in rural Massachusetts, Julius Lester reflects on that day following the death of Muhammad Ali on June 3, 2016.
As some of you know, I did radio work in New York City from 1968 to 1975 on WBAI-FM. For most of that time, I had my own weekly or twice weekly show. In the beginning, I did some reporting and helped to cover the 1968 Democratic Party Convention in Chicago, as well as the New York City teachers' school strike over the issue of community control of schools in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, and Brooklyn. In September of that year, I was asked if I'd like to interview Muhammad Ali. The fact that Ali would be willing to be interviewed by a small, non-commercial radio station is an indication that this was during that period from 1967 to 1970, when he had been stripped of his heavyweight championship for his refusal to be drafted into the Army and fight in Vietnam. Of course, as heavyweight boxing champion, Ali would have been assigned to tour Army bases, put on exhibitions, and do what he could to boost troop morale, which Joe Louis had done during World War II. But Ali refused to do even that. Though he is being lauded today for his moral courage, in September of 1968, he was vilified by the press and the public for being unpatriotic, and at the same time, excoriated as a fool because, banned from boxing, he gave up untold millions of dollars. While I did not hesitate to accept the assignment of interviewing Ali, I was also very nervous. Interviewing famous people was always challenging because it was doubtful that I could ask them anything they had not been asked many times. Interviewing Ali would be even more difficult because he was as skilled using words as he was his fists. WBAI was a radio station where people could hear programs they could not hear anywhere else. For me, that mandate had an added dimension, as my primary role at the time was to give media access to voices in the black community that were ignored or treated as adversaries by the mainstream media. How could I interview Muhammad Ali that would present the man behind the entertaining persona of someone who rapped before there was rap? The morning of the interview, I went to the New York Hilton on 7th Avenue in Manhattan, where Ali was staying. He was waiting for me in the lobby by himself. There was no entourage, and no one in the lobby gawked or pointed or noticed him at all. After exchanging pleasantries, I followed him onto the elevator and to his room floor. As we walked down the hallway, Ali suddenly started shadowboxing. The speed and power with which his arms moved through the air made a wind-like sound, whish, 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 whish. And I was afraid that the sound alone would render me unconscious. I could not imagine what it must have been like to have one's face and body on the receiving end of all that power. While shadowboxing down the hallway, Ali was silent. And if he was aware that he had thoroughly intimidated me, he didn't show it. I followed him into his room and was surprised at how small it was. As champion, I had no doubt that the Hilton would have given Ali the most luxurious suite in the hotel. But not only was he no longer champion, he was a pariah. The room was small, really small, with space enough only for twin beds, a small desk, and a chair. Someone, a man, was asleep in one of the beds. Ali sat down on the side of the other one, which was unmade. I sat in the chair at the table, set up the tape recorder and microphone. In thinking about the interview, I had decided to give Ali the opportunity to show a side of himself that the mainstream media had an aversion to. But it was a side I thought the BAI audience would like to experience. Although Muhammad Ali was best known as a boxer and as a man who had a way with words, his core identity was that as a member of the Nation of Islam. He was a devout Muslim, and I wanted to give him the opportunity to use the media to speak as a Muslim. Ali did not hesitate to take advantage of the chance to speak from his Muslim faith. He was a true believer and simply regurgitated the beliefs of the Nation of Islam, more often than not beginning sentences by invoking its leader, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. The beliefs espoused were politically conservative and, in one instance, identical to one held by the Ku Klux Klan. Where they believed in white supremacy and the separation of the races, Ali extolled black supremacy and racial separation. He was especially heated in condemning interracial marriage and the children of such marriages, so much so that I wondered if he knew that my wife at the time was white and that we had two children. I knew that he had recently become a father to a daughter, and I asked him what kind of woman he wanted her to be. His response was the stereotypical one of having dinner ready when a husband came home, being a good mother and wife, and a good Muslim. He said nothing that I had not heard before from members of the Nation of Islam or had read in The Muhammad Speaks, the nation's weekly newspaper. But near the end of the interview, he came alive in a new way. When I asked him about his response to those who said he had given up everything for nothing, his title, his reputation, and money, his pride in who he was and what he had done burst forth. And for the only time, I felt I was listening to Muhammad Ali, the man, and not the mouthpiece for the Nation of Islam. Quote, according to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the flesh and blood of our people is more important than some money. Money ain't worth a damn thing when it comes to wanting to be a man. And I'm proud to say that I'm the first black man in the history of America in boxing and entertainment who gave up all the white man's money, looked the white man in his eye, and told him the truth and stayed with his people. This is much greater than being with a white woman. I go to bed happy. I wake up happy. I'll go to jail for 10 years happy. And it'll always be said, there's one who didn't compromise. They have to look at me now as someone greater than a fighter. I get all respect because I follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Damn some money. If I gotta die, if I gotta sacrifice, let it be for my black brothers and sisters. Damn the money. I didn't spend more than an hour with Ali. And while I'd gotten the interview I wanted, I was saddened by his world view of black supremacy and his unquestioned and uncritical allegiance to Elijah Muhammad. But I did not question his integrity, because he had sacrificed everything for his religious convictions. By the mid-1970s, Ali moved away from the black supremacy of the Nation of Islam to Sunni Islam and later Sufi, and became a respected and beloved figure to Muslims all over the world. But on the morning I met him, the universal love and respect accorded him later in life was not imaginable. On that morning, he was more reviled than love, and he was broke because he tried to hit me up for $20 as I was leaving. In 1968, $20 was a lot of money, and working for BAI was a guarantee that I didn't have any money. I was never a fan of Ali's. He was an extraordinary self-promoter, and being the introvert that I am, I'm offended by someone who, with no trace of self-mockery, would proclaim repeatedly, "I am the greatest." But that's just me. But I respected the man I interviewed that morning, one day in September of 1968, because he paid a high price for his integrity. The 3 years he was not allowed to box eroded his skills, and he was never the fighter that he had been. My enduring memory of that morning is the sound of his arms going through the air as he shadow boxed his way down the hotel corridor to his room. It was terrifying.
That was former Pacifica producer Julius Lester. Mr. Lester is a retired professor from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and the author of 44 books since 1968. Here is Julius Lester's September 1968 interview in its entirety.
Muhammad Ali. And the first question I wanted to ask you is, you said you're going to be fighting soon. What about that?
Well, yes, we're working on a bout on a few Indian reservations. Now we are just about to wind up a deal, if everything goes like we expect it to, on a reservation not far from Seattle, Washington, and then there's one not too far from Phoenix. And the one in Seattle seems like the most likely, but we're now negotiating. My manager, Herbert Mohammed, and our business manager, C.B. Atkins, they've been working, and I think they have now gotten it. And they are talking about making me an honorary chief. And also this fight we hope to sell to the TV where everybody at home can see it. And the major problem is finding a suitable opponent. I don't think we can get Ellis and Frazier. They're ducking me. Joe Frazier and James Ellis, those the two so-called homemade champs they got. I think they ducking me. And now we're trying to negotiate in England, Germany, Canada, and possibly maybe some top contenders in the States. So that's where we stand right now. We're sure the fight and everything and the site is ready, but the contender's the hard thing to find.
Is Indian reservation the only place the man letting you fight now?
Well, yes. They have completely cut me off from earning a living, the government has here in America. They will not allow me to leave the country where I could make millions if I could just get out. I'm so popular and well-liked in Asia and Africa and Europe and Germany and all these countries will accept me, even Canada. But America took my passport where I couldn't leave and they won't let me work an exhibition or nothing in America. So all the Indians heard about this and they all got together and they said that with their laws or some type treaty or something that they have, they can let me pursue my trade on their land. Really, this is the Indian's land, and he's really the true American. So he's really the only one that's practicing the so-called American policy, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and this and that. So the real true Americans are gonna let me fight on their land, what little land that the white man left them.
He stated that you're going to be making a college tour this fall. Why, and what sort of things are you going to be talking about on the tour?
Well, I've been making college tours now for the past 2 years, but I did announce it publicly on the Johnny Carson show the other night. I've been mainly invited. I have 68 college invitations, and they all want me to speak on racial problems. What do I see as the solution? They want me to clarify the works and the missions of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. They want me to speak on the draft, why I denounced it. What do I think about the title? Why did they take it? How did I start boxing? And we just go on and go on. The presidential election, who am I for? And all these type questions. And there are many we answer and some we have to sort out that we don't answer. But usually I have all of my lectures designed from the book that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has out, A Message to the Black Man, speaking on titles such as We Must Respect and Protect Our Women, What the Muslims Want, What the Muslims Believe, Do We Must Do for Ourselves, We Must Help Self Before Helping Others, We Must Respect Our Own Selves and Unite and Separate from Our Slave Masters, and all type lectures. And then after these rather controversial issues, I have about an hour, sometimes 2 hours, and at the average I try to keep it at an hour to the longest question period. So this is what going in the colleges. I have different lectures for all white colleges, half integrated colleges, and all black colleges. I have different lectures laid out.
What sort of response do you get from white colleges and black colleges?
Well, it's just beautiful. Great. The people will just come just by the thousands, just grabbing me and chasing me. And mainly these college students of white, they are all with me on my belief on war, mainly Vietnam. And they all are rebelling now and fighting. And number one, this is why so many of the white colleges want me there, is because of my stand on draft and religious convictions and not taking a stand and not selling out Uncle Tom. And this really gets you a lot of respect, because many people make protesters and say what they're gonna do, but at the last minute they back out, mainly our people when it come to bucking white people. And my stand in this is making me much, much greater than I ever could been a boxer.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio Archives tribute to Muhammad Ali, using recordings in our collection. If you would like to purchase a copy of this program or our special Muhammad Ali 4-disc collection, go to PacificaRadioArchives.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. Remember, every donation helps us restore another treasure from our over 55,000 reel-to-reel tapes in our library. And now back to Julius Lester's September 1968 interview with Muhammad Ali.
Do you find that black students are responding to the message of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad?
Yes, sir. All the black students, they have their own Muslim meetings. They don't call them Muslim meetings, but they are. They don't allow no whites in the meetings now. And all of this is from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And they read the Muhammad Speaks newspapers. They call each other black now. They call each other brother. They call each other sister. He's been preaching this for the past now 38 years, but they don't follow him all the way. They don't want to follow him spiritually and divinely. They, for an example, you see the brother on the campus with his afro, with his African robe, and his dakiti and his beads and his sandals, but his white girl in his arm. So he's half black. If he was all the way black, he would have him a black girl to go along with his afro and his African robe and dakiti. Then you'll see the sister with her afro and her dakiti and her beads and her sandals and her mini miniskirt on. See, she's African from waist up, but twiggy from hips down. So she's half African and half English. So our people are not criticizing them. We cannot criticize a baby. Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us, who starts trying to talk. At least he's trying. And our people are starting to think in the way of black, but they're not yet all the way with the right man, but gradually they're coming more to the Muslim program daily. Everything that's designed, we must build, get our own businesses. They're arguing about they want their own businesses. That's the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. At the latest Black Power rally, they said, we want separate states, want our own states. That's the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And they called the white man the devil and all that. That's the beast. That's the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Everybody today talking back or preaching black, any black movement, check him out. He's an ex-Muslim. He was influenced by one of the ministers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He sneaks and read the Muhammad Speaks newspaper. They steal his program and go out and act like they just thought up something. And everything that our people are preaching and talking today, if any of our leaders hold any type of an audience, you'll find out that they're talking Muslim talk, but they just won't give the credit to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So this is just what we, answering your question about the black colleges, all of them know the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Every black man today, you find him and say, As-salamu alaykum. He'll say, wa alaykum salam. For the first time, he's speaking his own language. You hear names like Hassan and Omar and Akbar and Ahad and Ishmael and the all kind of names today. All this comes to Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So the only leader for us today, the only man for us today who has the key to free us from these evil, wicked slave masters is the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And our people are waking up to it daily, And answering your question, on the college campuses, they don't outright follow him, but they do take half of his program and use it to suit their needs. But in a few days, they'll soon be glad to accept all of him.
A few weeks ago in Muhammad Speaks, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad wrote an article where he said that he didn't feel that black people should wear the Afro hairstyle and the African dress. And I didn't quite understand that.
Well, to my knowledge, I heard him say that God, Allah, taught him everything that he's teaching us today. See, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, whether you follow him or not, is waking you up. And everything that he got came from the Supreme Being, and we believe everything that he say, not just one or two things, and then go and start something else. He says the law God gave him the style for us to wear, and we don't follow after no Africans. He says we are the original people, and Allah God has come to put us on top of civilization, and we don't have to go back to the jungles to get a style. We have a style. Muslims are neat, they're clean, neat haircuts, and the sisters are clean and respectable. We have our own style clothing, and he cannot influence his followers to follow after something that just came up yesterday when he's been here with his style for the past 38 years. We were following and trying to be like white people. Now we seem to be going to the jungles to look like the people in the jungles. Well, Sudanesians are Africans. You don't have to have thick lips and flat nose and a big woolly nappy head to be a black. Smoking on the white man's cigarette, smoking the white man's reefers, walking around with signs hollering, I'm black and I'm proud and I'm black and I'm beautiful. The white man don't walk around with signs saying he's white and beautiful and he's white and proud. He just acted and living so until he's got us now wanting to be white and like him. So if we really believe black was best and really was black and really believe black was beautiful, we don't have to go around trying to convince the world with big old signs on our back, I'm black and I'm beautiful, I'm black and I'm proud. If we are, we are. Be it and act it. So what I'm trying to say, many people say, well, you got the white man's clothes on, you got the white man's suit on. We are living in this civilization, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that we won't a country and a nation of our own, then when we're around our own, we can dress and do and can make our own styles. Well, to those who say you may have a white man's suit on and a white man this, well, we ride the white man's airplanes, or this is the white man's food, he grows it and cleans it. This is the white man's hotel, this is the white man's microphone. If we just want to be natural and be real natural, if we want to go from here to Los Angeles, we're going to have to take about 6 months to get there because we're going to have to use some elephants and some camels. So we're living in the modern time, and we're living in a time where we go along. Now, many of our people, I like to say, from Africa are getting nice, neat haircuts, and they put on nice suits and ties, and they come here to get education to go back to civilize and clean up and shave their own people. So we are not out to style ourselves after no Africans. Egyptians, Africans, these are beautiful people. People from Saudi Arabia, Africans, black beautiful people, and don't have to have a big woolly nappy head. People from, I know this is natural and this is our hair, but we are not here to really style after nobody. We have our own styles, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is our leader, and we understand that hair carries dirt and filth. And when we're around food, cooking, and eating, we should always be neat, mainly men. And I can see a sister having long hair, but the men shouldn't go around with big old long hair. And not condemning nobody who do, not condemning none of the brothers who do, but we who follow Honorable Elijah Muhammad believe everything he preach and teach. And if he's against it, then you can believe that there's something divinely not too good about it, because he's the real black teacher. He is the real black history teacher, and he's the one that's really for black people. So we can't condemn him for saying that we don't go for these naturals and afros. For an example, I was speaking to an African brother the other day, and I was saying something about how great black people are and how we win all the Olympic gold medals and how the black man in America is superior to everything you get a chance at. Africans, Mexicans, Cubans, nobody's as great as the American black man. He said, well, man,
if black men are so great, if you're so good, why you try to look like us? Why you try to dress like us? You wear your hair like us. Everything you do is like us if you're so good. Why don't you go be like yourself? Why you follow us? Why you style yourself after us?
So many of our people will say that Africans think that they are better than us. Africans don't think that they're better than us. They just have a knowledge of themselves, and they don't want to be classified as a Negro because they know a Negro is really nothing in white society or the world. It's dead to the knowledge of self. So then when we see ourselves going around styling ourselves after people from other countries and nations, they'll get a more prouder and greater and superior feeling. Elijah Muhammad teaches us, God, Allah taught him that we've been on the bottom of civilization, and Allah, God, has come to set us on the top. Not style after nobody in the jungles, but follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he's the one with the style. So not condemning none of our people who do this, but Honorable Elijah Muhammad, if he don't go for it, you can believe that all of those 700,000 to 800,000 Muslims in America won't go for it. And everybody who joined will get a neat haircut.
You have a 3-month-old daughter now. What sort of woman do you want her to be?
Just a righteous, good Muslim, believer in Allah, and staunch follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. That's all. And a good Muslim sister, such as my wife is, for another good Muslim brother. That's all she have to be.
What's a good Muslim sister?
Well, just a woman who follows the beliefs of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, pray 5 times a day, have the dinner waiting for the husband when he comes in, and wearing the Muslim dress, hiding her naked parts of her body, off the streets after dark, and just a nice, clean, respectable mother, a barrier of children, strong in the faith. And this is a good Muslim sister. Mainly belief in Allah, his messenger, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and who follow the MGT, the Muslim Girls Training's laws, 100%. And this is a good Muslim sister.
One last question. You said earlier that what you're doing now is much greater than being a heavyweight champion. A lot of folks would say that a lot has been taken away from you, that because you can't earn a living, because you could be a millionaire many times over, that you've lost a whole lot.
Yes, this is a man. Negroes have been made like white people. And many of them say, champ, you know something? You got a right to believe what you want and all this and all that, but what about the money? This is our trouble today. All Negro, so-called Negroes worry about his money. He's like the white man now. He'll blow up his mama for some money and sell out his people for some money. That's why we're nowhere today, because all the big Negroes with some money is up on the hill with the white folks, riding with the white folks, going to church with the white folks, marrying the white folks, shuffling and tomming and loving white folks, and they forget all about the brother down there in Harlem, his rent's due, living in a bad home, standing on the corner, nobody know him, nobody want him, and he rides by in his limousine. Well, let them niggas make it like me. I can't take no chance on losing my money. Once we become followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the flesh and the blood of our people is more important than the white man's money. Money don't mean nothing if you're black to the white man. I don't care if you can buy a $500 house or a $500,000 house, you still a nigger. Adam Clayton Powell, a big black man, bumped him off in your face unjustly. Martin Luther King, a big black man, bumped him off in your face unjustly. Muhammad Ali, the biggest black man in all history of boxing, bumped me off unjustly in your face. So excuse expression, money ain't worth a damn thing when it comes to wanting to be a man. And I'm proud to say that I'm the first black man in the history of all America, athlete and entertainer wise, who gave up all the white man's money, looked a white man in his eye and told him the truth, and stayed with his people. This is much greater than being in Sweden like Floyd Patterson or somebody with a white woman never coming through Harlem to see his people, and many more of these Uncle Tom niggas. And I'm just so happy. I go to bed happy. I wake up happy. And I'll go to jail for 10 years happy. And it'll always be said, there's one that didn't compromise. See, there are only two kind of men, those who compromise and those who take a stand. Those who take a stand are the ones who they write history about. These are the ones movies are made about. John Glenn was the first man to go into space, white man. They go into space every day now, but John Glenn was the one who dared to dare. He conquered it first. John Glenn will go down in history. Columbus was the first man to go around the world. They said the world is square, but Columbus ran around the first time. This doctor over in South Africa was the first one lately to transplant hearts. A black man did it in Chicago 100 years ago or so, but they don't tell you nothing about it. But he was the first one made known to the world. This doctor in South Africa. Now they transplant hearts every day, but that doctor will always go down. His statue will be there in history. You understand? So they'll have to say that I'm the first black man that took a stand and didn't get weak and go back. Now, many of our people make protests and say they're going to boycott and they're going to do this and do that. And then when the white man put the pressure on them, they back up. But I'm one who I hope and pray to Allah and his messenger, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that I be one black man that they can look at and say, he never had a white woman, never chased a white woman, turned down all $10 million in commercials, royalties, turned down the world heavyweight title. Where is he at? There he is over there sitting on the garbage can with the wine heads. He don't have to be over there. There he is talking to the prostitute. There he is picking up the brother out of alley, taking him to the Muslim temple. There he is selling a prostitute a Muslim newspaper. Ain't that something? He really don't have to do it. See, they have to look at me now greater than just in a boxing ring. Good fight, boy. White man got all the money. Two Negroes cut each other up. They can't talk. And he pat him on the back. Good fight, boy. Great fight, boy. Good show, boy. Good dancing, boy. Good show, boy. Huh? But they can't look at me like that. See, I get all respect because I follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. You may not like Rap Brown or Stokely Carmichael, but they get more respect than the richest Negroes in America, the most white folks loving Negroes in America. When Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael walk down the tree, traffic stops. Rap Brown, where? There he is. Stokely Carmichael, where? White folks jumping out of windows, looking at him, wanting to touch him. They admire warriors because they are warriors. They believe in dying and fighting for what they believe. They're giving up $90 million a day in Vietnam and the guts of their children for a principle. They died and fought the Indians. Money don't mean nothing when your people are free and hungry and catching hell. So all of these so-called Negroes listen to this show. I hope you learned something from this. Damn some money when it comes to your mama's freedom. You're so quick to go to Vietnam and fight and shoot and kill somebody you don't know, fighting so they can be free, and you come home and you get your head busted. So if I gotta die, if I gotta sacrifice, if I gotta suffer, let it be for my black brothers and sisters. Let it be for my mama and not somebody 10,000 miles from here. So when you understand what I'm saying, when you weigh it out, if it means money or Tom, damn the money.
You got time for one more question? Okay. You mentioned several times about black men and white women. What do you see wrong with black men and white women?
White men and black women and white men and black women is the worst thing we can do. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad says that God created us in nations, families, and tribes. Some people he made white and some he made black. Some he made brown, yellow, and red. And I'm sure the divine supreme being didn't make a mistake in his creation. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that God, Allah, taught him, a wise black man, and see if what I'm saying don't make sense. He teaches us that God beautified the planet Earth by putting all of these people in separate countries and nations to themselves. We find Chinese in China. We find Mexicans in Mexico. We find Israelis in Israel. We find Egyptians in Egypt. We find Pakistanis in Pakistan. We find Syrians in Syria. We find Ghanaians in Ghana. We find Nigerians in Nigeria. We find Algerians in Algeria. We find Ethiopians in Ethiopia. We find Indonesians in Indonesia. We find Arabians in Arabia. Beautiful. So what I'm trying to say is that God created the planet Earth in nations, families, and tribes. Now, every man wants a son to look like himself. Any white man listening to this show, any white woman listening to this show, in his or her right white mind, don't want little black girls and black girls, I would say want little black boys and black girls coming to marry their sons and daughters, and in return introducing their grandchildren as little half-brown, kinky-haired Negroes. It's a shame. It's a disgrace. Find a black baby in a white neighborhood, exile the whole family. Not going to have it, and we don't want it either. We don't mix up our beautiful black blood with no white folks. Too much in us now weakens us. A strong cup of coffee is black, and make you weak, put some cream in it. No black man listening to this show, no black woman in his or her right black mind won't little white boys and white girls coming to marry their sons and daughters and introducing their grandchildren as little half green-eyed, blonde-haired white folks. Black people are beautiful. We have beautiful sons. Our little brown girls are so beautiful. Black girls are so beautiful. And we should not want to mix up our blood with our 400-year-old open enemies of freedom, justice, and equality, who's lynched and burned and assassinated and castrated and raped us for 400 years. We are the only people on earth who want to marry and love white folks, and we should be the last ones, because we have been the ones who've been oppressed, denied freedom, justice, and equality. We are sick. We are brainwashed because we see a white Jesus who looks like the white woman. Same hair and blonde hair and blue eyes. We see the Lord's Supper's all white folks. All the angels in heaven, all white folks. Tarzan, the king of the jungle, he's white. White owl cigars, you've been brainwashed. White swan soap, king white soap, white cloud tissue paper, white rain hair rinse, white tornado flow wax, white plus toothpaste. Angel food cake is white, devil food cake is chocolate. Can't go to heaven, you walk on the milky white way. When you get there, you got to be washing lamb blood, he is white as snow, before you get in. Mary had a little lamb, his feet is white as snow. Snow white. Even go look at King Kong at the movies, a big old gorilla out of Africa, 14 stories high. He's running up and down Empire State Building and fighting guns and bullets just to keep a white woman in his arm. This is, you've been brainwashed. The black woman is the most beautiful. She has lips where a white woman don't. She don't need lipstick. She's got complexion. She's got beautiful black hair. She's got beautiful black eyes and not animal green and blue eyes. We are the original people God taught to honorable Elijah Muhammad. We are the best. And as Jesus said, truth will make you free. Not integrating, not swimming in, not walking in, not laying in, but truth will make you free. And once we hear the truth, we don't want no white woman. Chinese wants to marry some Chinese. Mexicans want a beautiful Mexican baby. They love the culture. They're not seeking to lose their blood through racial identity, through racial integration. Scotchmans love their bagpipes and their old culture. Indians love their culture. Puerto Ricans love old Puerto Rico. Mexicans love old Spanish town. Everybody love his own but the old Negro. While we seek him to lose our blood through racial integration, it's the worst thing we can do. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that integration means self-destruction, and the means to this end is exactly that, death and nothing less. So on these grounds, we are justified in sin, that we should respect and protect our women and keep the white man out of our neighborhoods on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sunday nights. That's what you're doing when you want to integrate. You're giving the white man a legal right to carry your woman to the hotel or the motel, give all kind of diseases and spotted up babies. He don't want to marry her, just want to use her. I travel from coast to coast every day. I know all the pimps and players. I know what I'm saying is right, and you do too, and the white folks listening know this is right. Muhammad is bold, and he makes us bold, and we're going to tell it. We'll never be respected if we don't respect our women, because the woman is the field which produces your nation. If you don't protect your nation field, you'll produce a bad nation. A farmer goes out and studies poisons and chemicals of the earth. He sprays these poisons and chemicals on his cabbage, on his beans, his tomatoes, seeking to kill any worm, any enemy looking to destroy his crop. We'll shoot one another
for stealing the other one's crop. We put scarecrows up in the garden to scare the enemy away. Now, how much more important is our mamas, is our sisters, or our daughters, or our wives, than our cabbage, our beans, and our corn, when she's the field which produces our sons and daughters? The white man has lynched 5 Negroes to get the white right one that he think he that touched his woman. He respects and protects his woman. The Mexican, you don't mess over Mexican women. You don't mess over Puerto Rican, African women. If you do, they read about you the next morning. Well, black men see white men come to our neighborhoods, carry our women to rooms, drive off in cars, don't throw a rock at the car, don't even protest. And we'll never be nothing as a nation until you respect our woman, because your first lesson comes from a woman, your first nurse is a woman, your mother's your first teacher. And if we so-called Negroes don't respect our mother, we'll never be nothing. Seek to marry your own, join on to your own kind, because the white race is doomed and there's no future with white folks. And under these grounds, it's suicide to want a white woman.
This is Julius Lester, and I've been talking to heavyweight champion and Muslim minister Muhammad Ali. Thank you very much.
That was former Pacifica producer Julius Lester's September 1968 interview with Muhammad Ali. Mr. Lester is a retired professor from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and the author of 44 books since 1968. We end now with a poem that Muhammad Ali gave on his return visit to UCLA in May of 1971.
And this poem tells about this little black boy who had a purpose in life, and he wanted to die fighting for his people's freedom. He just had a lot of bad experience with the whites in the South. Saw a few black people lynched, saw black women kicked in the pregnant stomachs, trying to get better busing and things down there. He hitchhiked up to a place called Brooklyn, New York, and joined a group called the Black Panthers. And he liked what they preached. And one day he's got his wish, dying, fighting for freedom. The Black Panthers got in a shootout. It was 50 of them and 3,000 policemen and National Guardsmen. The odds were against them that night. 25 Black Panthers died in a shootout, 24 surrendered. And one of them stayed on the rooftop. He wouldn't surrender. He was tired. He didn't care no more about living. He wanted to be free. And the policeman came out and said, "All right, 25 of your brothers are dead. 24 have surrendered. Come down or we coming up." And he looked off the rooftop and he shouted in poetic fashion. He said, "Better far from all I see to die fighting to be free. What more fitting end could be? Better surely than a bed where in broken health I'm led, lingering until I'm dead. Better than with prayers and pleas in the clutch of some disease, wasting slowly by degrees. Better than of heart attack or some dose of drug I lack. Let me die by being black. Better far that I should go, standing here against the foe. Is there sweeter death to know? Better than the bloody stain on some highway where I'm lain, torn by flying glass and pain. Better calling death to come than to die another dumb, muted victim of the slum. Better than of prison rot, if there's any choice I've got. Kill me here on the spot. Better far my fight to wage now while my blood boils with rage, lest it cool with ancient age. Better violent to die than to come down in Uncle Tom and try making peace just to live a lie. Better if I say my sooth, I shall die demanding truth while I'm still akin to youth. Better now than later on, now that fear of death is gone. Never mind another dawn."
Once we become followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the flesh and the blood of our people is more important than the white man's money. Money don't mean nothing if you're black to the white man. I don't care if you can buy a $500 house or a $500,000 house, you still a nigga. Adam Clayton Powell, a big black man, bumped him off in your face unjustly. Martin Luther King, a big black man, bumped him off in your face unjustly. Muhammad Ali, the biggest black man in all history boxing, bumped me off unjustly in your face. So excuse expression, money ain't worth a damn thing when it comes to wanting to be a man. And I'm proud to say that I'm the first black man in the history of all America, athlete and entertainer wise, gave up all the white man's money, looked a white man in his eye and told him the truth, and stayed with his people. And I'm just so happy. I go to bed happy, I wake up happy, and I'll go to jail for 10 years happy. And it'll always be said, there's one that didn't compromise. See, there are only two kind of men, those who compromise and those who take a stand. Those who take a stand are the ones who they write history about. These are the ones movies are made about. John Glenn was the first man to go into space, white man. They go into space every day now, but John Glenn was the one who dared to dare. He conquered it first. John Glenn will go down in history. So they'll have to say that I'm the first black man that took a stand and didn't get weak and go back. Now, many of our people make protests and say they're going to boycott and they're going to do this and do that. And then when the white man put the pressure on, they back up. But I'm one who I hope and pray to Allah and his messenger, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that I'll be one black man that they can look at and say, turn down all $10 million in commercial royalties. Turn down the world heavyweight title.
That does it for this edition of From the Vault. For a copy of this program, go to pacificaradioarchives.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. We salute Muhammad Ali for taking a stand in the face of great adversity and teaching us that each and every one of us can be the greatest in the world.
You're so quick to go to Vietnam and fight and shoot and kill somebody you don't know, fighting so they can be free, and you come home and you get your head busted. So if I gotta die, if I gotta sacrifice, if I gotta suffer, let it be for my black brothers and sisters. Let it be for my mama and not somebody 10,000 miles from here.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
I'm Wendy Rain.
And I'm Brian Curtis. And you're listening to Cool Solutions, climate action from the bottom up.
Until the start of the COVID pandemic, 11% of Americans worried about not having enough food. And